kind of crude, but when you're up here reading and you have like whatever papers or anything, just try not to rattle this thing or it's going to be really loud on the recording. I'll try to edit around it, but thank you.
Sudden switch today. Lisa Forrest, who provides the refreshments, couldn't be here. She just is not feeling well, and I have meetings all day and couldn't leave campus. So use your imagination and think about the tea and the cookies that you enjoy.
You better focus on the delights of the spirit.
It's just 4:30. Let's wait a couple minutes.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, sure. So, Kiara, you know what you gotta do for extra credit here?
You
got an idea? Objections to being photographed incidentally while this is going on too? Or is anybody on the run here or with this protection program and everything? No? Okay. Very good. Thank you. We just take some pictures for our webpage, that's all. Nothing more or less sinister than that.
So students, when you go on your Buffalo State homepage, my Buff State, good. Butler Library, click on Rooftop Poetry, and all these wonderful things come up. So you'll probably be hooked after today.
We have photos, and we have an archive of other recordings, too, from other readings and stuff. So it's all up there.
Well, I think I'll begin, and if some students come in, then they do, all the better. So, welcome. Thank you for coming today. I am delighted to present two poets, Nathan Graziano and David Hadbonik. Is that correct or close enough?
Mm-hmm.
Want to say it for me?
Hadbonik.
Okay. All right. So, Nathan, you are here first, so I imagine you're beginning? Okay. I'm so sorry that Lisa Forrest isn't here today for us, and she's so sorry that she can't be here, but it couldn't be avoided. So, Nathan Graziano lives in Manchester, New Hampshire, with his wife and two children. He is the author of Teaching Metaphors, Not So Profound, Frostbite, and 7 chapbooks of poetry and fiction. His work has appeared in Rattle, Night Train, Freight Stories, The Co-Review, The Owen Wister Review, and others. His third book of poetry, After the Honeymoon, will be published in fall 2009. So maybe that's quite soon. We'll look forward to it. Oh, good. Wonderful. Okay. Then please come up and entertain us.
No touching.
No touching.
Got you. All right. Well, thank you for coming. I came kind of a long way. I'm from New Hampshire, but my publisher, who I think is paying for parking right now.
If you want to just wait a couple of minutes, feel free.
We're going to be, I'm going to be doing something like 13 readings in the next two weeks.
Okay.
So
okay.
I think he's going to get pretty tired of listening to me. So I'll just, I'll read a couple of things. I'm not going to hold you up long here. So I actually want to start with a piece of flash fiction. This was originally published in Night Train, and it's a piece called Moonwalk. I don't know if that's unconventional for a poetry reading, but I think, you know, we're flash fiction and prose poetry, you know, all of these genres are starting to merge a bit here, so. All right, it's called Moonwalk. When Lisa and I split, she took it all. The house, our one respectable car, and Gary, the parrot I taught to say fuck you. And she cheated on me. Go figure. But this was back before I got sober. And at the time, I did what any jilted drunk would do. I rented a cheap, one-room place in a bad part of town and spiraled into a stormy bender. Days melded into other drunken days, weeks into interminable weeks, all boiling in a cracked cauldron of my own self-loathing. I was 3 weeks deep into my bender and pretty tight the night Jackson called. It was the first time I'd heard from him in 5 years, and he called to tell me his plane would be arriving in Logan Airport at 10:15. Jackson, a beefy guy whose real name was Brian Unger, gave birth to the nickname one night when he did an improbably perfect moonwalk across the filthy kitchen tiles while looped at a frat party. This was a good decade after the dance step reached its peak in popularity. When Jackson called me from O'Hare in Chicago, he said that he and his wife Stacy were on the skids, and that's all he said. So I wrote down the flight number in red ink on the back of my hand, then drove, heavy-lidded and sweaty, to the airport in my dented Honda Accord with a styrofoam cooler of cold Coors Light cans in the back seat. As I waited for Jackson at the terminal gate, I passed the time eyeing this pretty young thing in a yellow sundress, chewing her nails to the cuticles. After blowing into my hand and smelling my breath, yes, it reeked of beer, I began to inch closer. Her smooth golden legs spilled from the hem of her dress like two cold drinks, capable of washing down the acrid taste on the back of my tongue that Lisa left. A taste I couldn't seem to swallow. Dressed in a blue Bermuda shirt, torn khaki shorts and sandals, I was dressed for Jackson, not a pretty young thing in a yellow sundress. She was out of my league, but I thought, fuck it, where's the harm? Are you waiting for someone? I asked the girl. I hadn't spoken to a woman since Lisa and I split, and now, years after this has gone down, does it occur to me how ridiculous that question was? She gave me a once-over, then rolled her eyes. My boyfriend, she said. Have you been together long? I haven't met him yet. We hooked up on the internet. Just be careful, I said. Make sure he's not a serial killer. She said, thanks for your concern. A sweet southern voice announced the arrival of the flight from O'Hare, and I stepped back from the girl in the yellow sundress and waited for my friend Jackson. One of the first guys out of the gate was the boyfriend, not Jackson, and I watched the girl's face stiffen up with the fixed smile of a jack-o'-lantern, one of the smooth golden legs trembling like a stalk of barley in a stern breeze. Jackson was one of the last people out of the tunnel. We shook hands and patted each other on the back. Mark, my friend, I'm wearing another man's underwear, Jackson said. Jackson? What the hell? They're these French-cut, marble-bag man panties, but I didn't have anything clean, so I put them on. Stacy must be humping a male dancer. Normal guys like us, we don't wear man panties. How do they feel? I watched as the girl in the yellow sundress planted a dry kiss on the lips of a serial killer. Tight, man. Really tight. So that's actually one story that's part of a longer collection where that couple, as you can tell, has some problems. I'm going to read a couple from my last book and then just a few from... set my cell phone. Jesus. Then just a few from the new one. thanks, Jim. I actually work as a high school teacher. And this collection was written about some of the experiences I've had teaching high school. Some of the students, some of the faculty, etc. So I'm going to read a few from here. And I'll start with a sadly, this is true, but on a former student spread in Hustler magazine. She seemed much happier in the nude, with her fingers clamped to stiff nipples and legs spread wide in a clawfoot tub, than she ever did in my classroom, half listening to me blather about Blake, her head down on the desktop. As I searched for lint in her belly button and dirt behind her airbrushed ears, I realized she would not know Hamlet if he were to show up at her photo shoot with his foil's tip dipped in poison and drawn to the greasy photographer's throat. Even if the prince were to introduce himself by name, nothing would register, as if Hamlet were plucked from a phone book. But she couldn't mistake the look in his eyes when she glanced back from her pose to find him ready to cry or scream. This is the title poem from the book, Teaching Metaphors. I stood, a concrete form, in front of 25 adolescents. They were stunned by boredom, watching the second hand on the wall clock and drawing caricatures of me in their notebooks. I forged on and explained that metaphors are the beautiful women in the language lounge, their long legs crossed at the ankles. Implied metaphors blow kisses and flirt with their eyes. Extended metaphors sweat in the sheets, payment for sticking around for the entire poem. And sexual metaphors need to be avoided at all costs. A boy in the back began to snore. A week later, when I asked for an example of a metaphor, the same boy said, "Fuck you, I hate this class." Abstractions aren't for everyone. Sorry. You know, the truth is that I got my first cell phone on Friday, and I really don't know what I'm doing with it yet. And so I thought I had it shut off. I just learned to text message yesterday, which is a thrill in my life now.
Interesting to be interrupted by your own.
By my own, I know. I know. Because you want it, because my urge is to be indignant. Like, oh, who left their cell phone? And then it's mine. Damn it. All right, I'm going to I'm gonna read about a couple of my colleagues here. Of course, there is a disclaimer in the front of the book that the characters are fictional and any resemblance to people living or dead is purely coincidental. So keep that in mind. Not that you'll ever see these people, but... Gerrans. The varsity football coach, who teaches science for the stipend, sits beside the soda machine in the teacher's lounge with two younger versions of himself, both of whom coach girls basketball while moonlighting as special ed teachers. All three men are drinking Diet Cokes and don't know me from Stephen Hawking, despite the fact that I've been on the faculty with them for 5 years. "Hey, Nick," the varsity football coach says. "You teach English or something, right?" "My name's Nate. Yeah, whatever. Anyway, we were just wondering, what the hell is a gerund? I noticed that the varsity football coach has cultivated a thick bushel of black hair sprouting from each eardrum, and speculate this could be Darwinian, protecting his hearing from the shriek of his whistle. His cronies have smaller bushels, nothing quite as impressive, but compelling. It's a verbal that functions as a noun, I said. For example, as educators, failing to identify word functions is egregious. No shit, said the varsity football coach, and shrugs at his friends, who scratch their chins. We were completely wrong. Thanks, Nick. And I guess I'll just read a couple from the new book here, After the Honeymoon. This came out a couple of weeks ago, about a week before I got my cell phone. So two big events in my life in the last 2 weeks here. Well, it is my wife's birthday on Monday. And I'm not going to be here. So this is actually a poem that I wrote that was my gift to her after our first year of marriage. You know, at the time we didn't have a lot of money. So it's called The Paper Ark. 1. It seems appropriate 9 days before our first anniversary, cold water would leak from the ceiling in our basement. A problem we cannot afford to fix. So we set a mop bucket below the drip and watch and wiggle our wedding rings. Waterlogged, I build an ark out of old newspaper in case of a flood. 2. We never had a real wedding, according to the rules of real wedding people. There are supposed to be invitations printed in calligraphy, banquet halls and plated chicken dinners, open bars and drunken uncles, and peach, chiffon, bridesmaid dresses. There's supposed to be a bridal gown, white like a new thought, lacy with a train and a veil to hide anxious eyes. There's supposed to be a wedding song and a slow dance. It's never supposed to rain. 3. The bucket is about to overflow. But we bought this house knowing I couldn't fix a leak. I don't own a toolbox. You're pacing the kitchen floor on the phone with your father. He tells you to find a man who can confront pipes and save you from the drip that spits on your security. He tells you that a poet in a leaky house is like an atheist in a foxhole. It's the only simile he knows. He might be right, but he hasn't seen my ark. 4. Some nights we wish for more bed between us. Our tirades turn into snores that turn into sighs that turn into snores eventually. Some nights we can't sleep in the same bed, so one of us carries a pillow to the couch and slips into a restless slumber in front of the blue glow of the television set. Some nights the baby sleeps between us. We reach for each other's hands and apologize with our fingertips. 5. The three of us board the paper ark I built while the world drowns in things we can't afford. I sing sailor songs and hold you both while we dance to the rhythm of a distant drip. A slow dance, our wedding song. Okay, this poem is called Crash, and I don't know if the publisher is going to have these broadsides available, but I do deal a lot with marriage and parenthood in this collection. Thematically, it's kind of what ties it together. Marriage isn't always easy. So Crash. It's a collision in slow motion. Our kids are the casualties. We smoke the cigarettes we quit as a leaf pile blazes in a neighbor's yard. I pluck the burning grass from our lawn and offer it to a trail of smoke. I've never been more in love than when we met you whisper. Wiping the blood from my brow, I agree. And just a couple more here, and then we'll call it a day. This is actually a poem I wrote for my son. He's four now. He was two when I wrote it. And he got very very upset one year because he thought that the Easter Bunny wasn't going to come to our house. It was me trying to explain this to a two-year-old. It's called Screwed by the Easter Bunny. My two-year-old son scrapes rabbit shit from the shoe with a twig from a dying tree. He tells me, the Easter Bunny isn't coming this year. No baskets, no eggs, no chocolate critters to behead. He's not coming, my son screams. I tell him, rabbits don't have thumbs. Therefore, they could never hold a basket or palm an egg with plausibility still intact. Rabbits don't have the giving instinct or the desire to watch a loved one's eyes light up like a pair of suns behind a closed tomb. Starting next year, I tell my son, we'll stop celebrating rabbits and resurrections on Easter. Instead, we'll toast to the absence of ghosts, the empty spaces beneath the sink. And in place of painted eggs, we'll stuff our fists in our mouths, then joyride through cemeteries, listening to static hum on AM radio, like a room of cynics drunk at a seance. We'll cry shenanigans as we shift the candle's flame and scoff at the things we don't feel or see. I'll just do two more. This is an ongoing fight at my house. Maybe this is crossing the line of good taste, but I don't know. Reasons why I give my wife for not having a vasectomy. One, think of the lesbian couple, the sweet older women we don't know yet, who will bring us fresh tomatoes in the summer. And all they ask in return is a sampling of my seed, a spatter of my chromosomes, to plant in their womb and nurture and nurse to life, a projection of their love, born of our selfishness. Imagine Christmas, the boy with my mouth and brow pushing a plastic fire truck across a hardwood floor. With our own kids and new clothes, we'll stop to visit. I'll bring some Chianti, and the boy his first Red Sox hat. Two. Then there was the botch job on my cousin Bob. The poor guy was sliced up like an Easter ham, his eyes squeezed shut, tears ripping down his cheeks as the doctor used chopsticks to find his vas deferens. Oh, how Bob squirmed and screamed and begged for the Lord's infinite mercy, spitting our fathers as that butcher in the lab coat, a blowtorch lit, looked Bob in the eyes and said, "Ain't nothing but pain." After the operation, when the suitors were removed, Bob's wife left him for a drummer in a rock band, who appeared, at least on stage, to be far more virile. The last one I'll read here is the last poem in the book. It's called Summer Lightning. It's going to be all right, I whisper without moving my lips. Our kids are in bed between us while the thunder shrugs, wrapped in the black clouds as the sky's switch is fiddled. The rain taps the window like a courteous burglar. We lie as still as sculptures of our sleeping selves, impenetrable beneath the sheet that covers our legs. Behind my eyes, my vices draw guns, sons of bitches. They've pulled the blinds, cordoned my mind, and shown havoc to you, me, and the precious lives between us, whose tiny breath is as soft as a piano's tears. Crash. Our son is startled awake. Brave boy. He throws forward his bony chest and tells us, I'm all right, as our daughter buries herself in the nook of my arms and seeks shelter in the safety of my shoulder. now 34, a husband and father. I flex to protect the three of you from the violence of the storm. But for every roof I've built, my good intentions can't patch the holes my vices stab with shards from broken bottles. Here, in this summer storm, 6 days without a drop, I gather you and our children in my still shaking arms, then put my vices to rest, bully them to sleep, and promise my family, my loves, it's going to be all right. So, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. Will you be reading anywhere else?